CliffCentral.com.
Right. Good morning. And if you've just joined us, welcome to the Burning Platform, which is our opportunity to look at some of the big stories that are going on in the world, some of the big stories that affect us here in South Africa, and the things that everybody is talking about. Current affairs, news, big developments, politics, all of that stuff, and a whole lot more. I'm joined, as always, by Phumi Mashego. And we will be joined this morning by Nicole Fritz, who I'm delighted to welcome to the show. Nicole Fritz is the executive director of the Helen Suzman Foundation. She has been since January of this year. She was a Business Day columnist before that and has served in a number of prominent civil society organizations over her career, including being the executive director of Freedom Under Law, who we've mentioned so many times on this show, so it's a travesty, actually, that we're only speaking to Nicole now for the first time, because Freedom Under Law has done some incredible and meaningful and important and essential work in maintaining, you know, the kind of the civil part of society, the fact that in so many ways we depend on government and sometimes someone has to hold government to account. Freedom Under Law is a massively important part and a component of a free and hopefully functional liberal democracy like South Africa. And we certainly can give them credit for having done much to foster and forward the cause of a society that understands the rule of law, a society that tries to make things a little more free, a little more sensible, a little more fair in a country where there's so little of that that's going on. So we're thrilled to have her here this morning. She's also been executive director of the South African Litigation Center. So we got lots to talk to Nicole about. Pumi's here. And Nicole, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the show. I'm really, really sorry it's taken us so very long to get you on, as I said in the introduction. But I'm delighted to have you with us this morning.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for that incredibly generous introduction. It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, it was Phumi who actually sent your name to the producers and said, we have no excuse to not have Nicole on after all this time. And really, I did mean that you've come up, if not by name, then certainly by the organization's names that you've headed. The Helen Suzman Foundation has done tremendous work even long before you joined them. They continue to. But Freedom Under Law, just tell people a little bit, for those who don't know and who for whom my introduction was perhaps scant, give them some idea of what Freedom Under Law has been up to and also what the Helen Suzman Foundation's mandate is.
Sure. So just to start off with and to tell you a little bit about Freedom Under Law, and that was a terrifically generous introduction, and I wish I could take credit for the incredible work that that Freedom Under Law has done. But I think, you know, real tribute should be paid to Judge Johan Krechler, who was one right. of the first Constitutional Court judges appointed by former President Nelson Mandela to sit on that court. Judge Johan Krechler is the chair of Freedom Under Law. And it was set up more than a decade ago. I think really one of the reasons for it being put together, and the idea is to defend rule of law and constitutionalism in South Africa, was what happened in respect of you know, still current Western Cape Judge President John Floppe, who had made an overture to two then sitting Constitutional Court judges, sought to influence them to essentially render judgment in favor of then he. It was expected that he would be president, Jacob Zuma. He wasn't yet. A complaint was then lodged by the Constitutional Court, all the judges of the Constitutional Court, against this attempt to improperly influence the highest court. And I mean, it's just hard to imagine a more terrifying sort of prospect of sort of attack on the independence of courts than a judge president of so busy, so prominent a division as the Western Cape division, making right. an approach on judges in the highest court of the land and asking them to essentially render a decision in favor of a man that was expected to be the president and then subsequently was the president of South Africa. And that complaint was put before the Judicial Service Commission. And initially the Judicial Service Commission, and it should be said, Judge President Floppe put in a counter complaint against the judges of the Constitutional Court saying that they had sort of besmirched his reputation. but both those complaints were then dismissed on the part of the Judicial Service Commission. They said, no, there's, we're not going to proceed with this. And it was on the back of freedom of under law then going to court and asking for a review and set aside of the decision of the Judicial Service Commission's decision to set those, to not proceed with that disciplinary process, that we saw this, you know, this process that was then reinstituted, but at an agonizingly slow pace, so that it was only last year that the Judicial Conduct Tribunal says, yes, in fact, Judge President John Tlope is guilty mm-hmm. of gross judicial misconduct and should be impeached. And that was upheld by the JSC finally. But we now know that there are being all sorts of attempts to appeal that decision, that has to appeal to attempt to interdict any suspension of him, sort of pending the finalization of this matter. So, you know, essentially 15 years later, and we still don't see any final conclusion to this matter. But I have to say, if it hadn't been for freedom under law, for its board, and for particularly for Judge Krikler's efforts. And I think mm-hmm. what needs to be recognized by the public is that Judge Krikler could very well have decided that actually, you know, he was going to enjoy his retirement. He had made an enormous contribution to South Africa as it was. He had sat on the Constitutional Court, rendered some of our most significant jurisprudence in this country.
Yes.
But in fact, what he decided in his retirement is to use that to make another enormous contribution to South Africa. And so I would say that, you know, huge tribute needs to be paid to Judge Krikler. I am full of admiration for him and, you know, have such fondness for him. So that's a bit long, but that's freedom under law. And that's only one matter that it took up. But that was a matter which took 15 years and we're still not at the end of it.
But thank God you guys pursued it when you were there and they continued to fight this fight, because really it seems to me kind of ridiculous that Judge John Tlope is still there, despite everything that's been brought to bear in trying to get him out of his position. It's unbelievable. It shows you that some people, especially in the judiciary, can really stick around despite every attempt to break them loose. Tell us a little bit about the Helen Suzman Foundation too, and then we can move into some current affairs and your comments and some of the things that are going on, because I think those are important too.
Sure. And thank you. I mean, the Helen Suzman Foundation obviously was a foundation that was established to try and honor the legacy of Helen Suzman, who for so many years was kind of a lone voice in the South African Parliament during apartheid, when it was a whites-only parliament, seeking to oppose the policies of the national government. So was a single woman.
They used to call her in Parliament the Honorable Member from Gauteng. And they were very...
They wouldn't even call her by name.
They wouldn't even call her by name, exactly. Yeah, that's quite right. And, I mean, she was, in her time, first of all, to be a woman, and second of all, to have espoused the views that she did and to stand up for people who were just not being represented at all. I mean, she was unbelievable. She was a force of nature.
Fire in her pen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And it's quite a formidable sort of legacy to obviously try and live up to. I mean, she did. She had members of parliament and cabinet ministers who would say, you know, you're very lucky you're not my wife because I would beat you. And that was the kind of, would pass for sort of parliamentary decorum in the house then. So that was the kind of, you know, that was, that's the example. That's the legacy that we're trying to live up to. And it's about sort of protecting, strengthening, promoting a liberal constitutional democracy in South Africa. So really trying to shore up rule of law and constitutionalism with the intention that would better sort of promote the rights of all South Africans, right? We know our constitution is replete with a number of human rights that are protected in the Bill of Rights, so to ensure that those are protected, those are given life and realized. And so that's very much the what the mandate of the Helen Suzman Foundation is. As you've indicated, I've only taken over at the beginning of this year, so I haven't been there for very long. It has done a tremendous amount of work. As I said, it's got this legacy, this quite intimidating legacy to try and promote and uphold. We're doing some exciting work.
Sounds terrific. I'm really, really pleased that there are NGOs like these that are able to do this stuff. A lot of people are very nervous about NGOs because all over the world, you know, there's some of them that do tremendous work and there's some of them that are also quite nefarious and get involved in lobbying in ways that are very single issue, let's say. Obviously, in the case of both of these, I think they have they've earned the respect of so many South Africans for standing up for the things which I think we all consider to be really, really integral to a functional constitutional democracy. Do you agree, Pums?
And I think the single issue, the thing about it is that the single issue that they're focused on is really our constitutional democracy. And the constitution that we have, and we've spoken about this before, is looked up to all over the world, but it really doesn't mean a damn thing if we can't defend it in courts, and if it doesn't defend the freedoms of the people of South Africa, you know. And that for me is why this is one of these particular NGOs are one of those. And just Gareth, I'm going to pivot to a new issue that is currently in the Helen Suzman. I mean, we see Helen Suzman Foundation as the friend of the court in so many court cases that are happening right now. And it's always, you know, when they come up, it's always what does that really mean, friend of the court? And maybe this is the opportunity, before I ask you about this particular issue, to just tell us a little bit about what that really means when an organization becomes a friend of the court and what they're there to do during that court proceeding.
Sure. Thanks, Pumi. So, you know, the phrase is amicus or amici, is a friend of the court. And the idea is that you as an organization or even as an individual can make an application to be an amicus. And the idea then is that your role is to be a friend of the court. So it is not necessary, you know, it's not to take a specific position on behalf of any of the parties. So generally with a court case, you'll have an applicant and a respondent, or, you know, in the criminal case, you'll have the prosecution and the defense. The role of the amici is not to line up, you know, in the shadows of either of those parties, but to be a friend of the court. It doesn't mean that your submissions aren't necessarily going to advance one or other side, but the idea is I'm not necessarily here to litigate this matter. But I'm here to offer submissions to the court that I think will be helpful in its determination of the matter. So we don't think that the papers that have been put to the court on the part of the applicant or the respondent exhaust what needs to be taken into account when you as the court are considering this matter. So here are some submissions, and we're coming to you, if we're doing this properly, which is, here are some submissions which we think, you know, as you make your determinations, you should also take into account, because they give you a broader context or another issue, another angle that needs to be considered.
Right. Can we look at a couple of stories here? I mean, if there's any place that we need a friend of the court to be able to bring people to bear for making terrible decisions that impact really awfully on the lives of ordinary South Africans, we've seen the new Chief Justice presiding over these state capture hearings, and we hear lots of really interesting stories about what's been going on behind the scenes over the last 10 to 12 years in South Africa, the kinds of skullduggery that have involved ministers, that have involved big business, that have involved consultants, and that have involved just straight-up criminals. Some of the people that seem to get by with the least amount of the least amount of kind of public outrage seem to be these big international firms. And I want to talk here in particular about Bain. I want to talk about McKinsey, who've all been named in these reports and who really have been absolutely scurrilous in the way that they have taken advantage of, first of all, the corruptibility of our government. Second of all, the ignorance of the ordinary South African. And third of all, the willingness of other businesses and of the South African government to comply with what is essentially an asset stripping and a, I mean, it's a total
theft,
a pillaging,
wholesale theft.
A wholesale theft of this country's assets and our tax money. And these companies just carry on doing what they're doing. Now, are we going to take serious steps to prevent them from doing this again? Or are we just going to open the doors to them and say, yes, bring in your consultants, draw up plans for state capture, and give them to these criminals to enact?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more, Gareth. And I have to say, Bain is one that really makes my blood boil because, I mean, obviously, you know, government and government actors, and we've seen just the kind of wholesale corruption that has been exposed through the Zondo Commission. Obviously, those officials have taken an oath to serve in the public interest, and to the extent that they have deviated from that oath, that is really horrific and probably the greater crime if you're going to compare these things. But the fact that these prestigious blue chip international corporates have come here, and in the case of SARS, right, the South African Revenue Service was a kind of model, global model for revenue collection. It was held up around the world as an example to be emulated. And, you know, it had doubled its revenue collection in, you know, a short number of years. So here it is, and Bain comes, and, you know, before even Tom Miyane is announced as the new head of SARS, like a year in advance, they are privy to that information. They are essentially buying influence from this company, Amber Bright, who is close to Zuma. So they know that, and they start preparing. I mean, what is essentially a sham restructuring, because SARS doesn't need restructuring. They, when Tom Miyane is appointed, they then go in and essentially break SARS. They dismantle it. Yeah. They strip it of its investigative capacity. So not only is there then the shortfall in revenue collection, but actually there is an acceleration of criminal activity because SARS's investigative capacities are then broken. And so you have this hollowed out organization, which is then sort of essentially handed back to South Africa. Millions and millions are charged in fees, you know, to the benefit of Bain. And what's not understood is that in a developing constitution such as ourselves, right, if we are to realize on the promises of the constitution, and particularly socioeconomic rights, so rights to access healthcare, housing, education, all that depends really largely on our revenue collection. You incapacitate SARS and you essentially break our constitutional democracy. And this is what Bain does. And then Bain says, you know, initially it's kind of denied, oh, we've done nothing wrong. These were kind of maybe, you know, kind of rogue apples in South Africa, but actually globally we didn't know, which is nonsense, actually, because the global partners were absolutely integrated into the South African operations. And then they're like, oh, sorry, you know, here are your fees back. But of course, if you are going to make good on the harm, they need to take into account that South Africa basically lost billions in revenue collection as a result of Bain's activities at SARS. And really, there has to be action taken, ideally, at the hands of our authorities. It cannot be that Bain receives its stiffest penalties from the likes of the UK government. But you have to applaud what the UK government has just done. I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg announcing that there's a 3-year ban on Bain, that it will not be receiving any work from the Cabinet Office for those 3 years. And that's as a result of the efforts of Lord Peter Hain and Athol Williams, the whistleblower, who has left South Africa because he has faced such danger.
Yeah, we had him on the show not so long ago.
Exactly.
And I think,
you know, I think lots of, and a number of civil society organizations are looking at other foreign jurisdictions which have legal frameworks which might allow us to go after Bain. For instance, in the United States, in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, Bain is headquartered there. But as I said, really, we need to see action taken against these corporates here in South Africa because the harm has been most acutely felt here.
Couldn't agree more. And it drives me crazy that we continue to rely on these companies and their reputations don't seem to be much tarnished by their really, really bad acting in a place like South Africa. They don't seem to be penalized for it internationally, except in this very rare case that you've just mentioned in the UK. All right, so we'll do what we can there. Let's just talk for a minute about something else that's quite controversial, is this basic income grant. Because we spoke a lot about this during the pandemic, obviously. We realized people were stretched. There was a huge amount of urgency. We now see that they want to take that basic income grant up. They want to double it. Some people are complaining that that's not even enough. We need to give people 1,000 rand a month as a basic income grant. Of course, all this money has to come from somewhere. So it's all good and well, and even for NGOs to start saying, well, you must make it this much, when we just don't have that much money. And you talked about SARS just a moment ago. I mean, South Africans are stretched to the point where even the commissioner of SARS, Edward Kiesvet, is saying that there is a high likelihood that if they tinker too much with tax, that there may be some kind of a tax revolt, that already so many people who have lots and lots of money have sent it all overseas, and all you'll be doing is punishing hard-working middle-class South Africans if tax is fiddled with. So where is this money to come from? And it's all good and well to talk about this, but is it even a practical possibility in a place like this?
Gareth, I recognize that, and I think that there has been lots of discussion, and obviously, you know, very reputable, respectable entities are coming out and they're saying, I mean, Business Unity South Africa has just put out a report and they're saying, look, it really doesn't seem affordable for us, but, you know, if we are going to do it, here's how one might do it, and it's, you know, kind of a little bit of tinkering with that and personal income tax. But I have to say, I mean, the fact is we're talking at the moment, it's 350 Rand, right? That's and what they have done is increase the eligibility, so, and allow a larger number of South Africans to qualify for this 350 Rand. Essentially, in order to qualify, you can't be earning more than the food poverty line, which is around, I think, 695 Rand. But to get a grant of 350 Rand, when we're talking that the food poverty line is around 695, means that, you know, if you are earning nothing, which, you know, large numbers of those recipients are, you're not getting enough to actually feed yourself. Or and we're hearing these terrible stories, devastating stories about, you know, children having to eat sand essentially in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal because they are so starving. We know what happened in July last year, and it's true that that was absolutely kind of orchestrated and manipulated by political actors. But we also have a desperate population, right? And I think for all sorts of reasons, and if we take seriously our constitutional commitments, it must make us all ill to think of the huge number of kind of hunger and poverty in this country. And we talk about the social compact, I mean, and how we might sort of ensure that there is greater sort of social unity and cohesion. And the Institute for Economic Justice is coming out, I mean, it's done some sort of modeling, and some of those proposals are really incredibly interesting. So they're talking about what it might mean to impose a 1% tax hike on the wealthiest 1% of South Africans, and how much that would raise. And it might, you know, one might say, oh, well, you know, the wealthy are already taxed hard. But if you looked at, if you look at that, and this idea that, I mean, if one could design a mechanism where actually the wealthiest in South Africa, 1%, were supporting those who are in direst poverty, so that rather than sitting on these two extreme ends, one was actually sort of closing the circle. And what that might allow, like if we had a reliable social security net, what that might allow in terms of us reimagining other things in our economy, like labor law and disinvestment policies, if people understand, you know, acutely, because they're on the, you know, they're getting their grants are funded by those who have this capital, what that might mean to induce positive policies against disinvestment in South Africa. And so I'm not an economist, I don't have the answer, but I really would hope that we're sitting down and having imaginative conversations about how we might make this a reality, because I think that we have to recognize that it's not only unconscionable that people are living in this type of poverty and hunger, but that actually it makes this country unsustainable.
Well, shouldn't we first of all figure out how we can stop bad actors within the government from pilfering huge quantities of this money before we place an additional burden on taxpayers? I mean, a lot of people in this country will say, well, I'm already supporting some 16 to 20 people that I don't know, that I didn't make, that I'm not actually responsible for with my tax money. And for the ordinary taxpaying South African who's paying not only the ordinary taxes, which everyone pays, but also a quite hefty income tax, capital gains tax, business tax, all of these things, starting to make it very, very difficult for people to operate. And I hate to say it, but it does sound a bit Bernie Sanders to be talking about the top 1% and how if we tax the top 1%, we can get the money to help the poorest of the poor. And it never works that way. There's very, very little evidence that that stuff ever trickles down to the people who actually need it. It gets stolen by bureaucrats.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't disagree with that characterization of South Africa. I also think, I mean, one of the things is nobody's saying this is the silver bullet, right? Yeah. I mean, this idea that this is going to sort of take us, you know, and suddenly we'll be a happy, stable, secure society is nonsense. That, you know, this type of conversation and discussion also has to go alongside all sorts of other policies about, you know, directed at economic growth and job creation.
Absolutely.
So it's not about it being in isolation. But I do think that we have to recognize, right, that we are an anomalous society in the sense that, one, we are the most unequal in the world, right? And even after imposition of our fiscal system, so our tax system, which is redistributive, even after that, we're still more unequal than other countries in the world prior to a kind of fiscal prior to them being taxed. And so, you know, it can't be, oh, well, it's not worked anywhere else. I mean, we have to look at a solution that is specific to South Africa.
But it does,
isn't it?
It does become ideological it becomes almost like religious, this idea of we've got to address inequality. And we see governments all over the world trying to do this and failing because it requires social engineering of the kind that has led to nothing but ugliness and devastation where it's been employed. And I as much as I understand that people are upset by, and rightly so, unfairness, inequality, inequity, wherever they see it, nobody can help feeling sorry for people who have absolutely nothing, unless you're a complete psychopath. And nobody can help thinking, well, it seems that completely inappropriate that someone should have 8 houses and 16 cars where, you know, other people in the country have nothing to eat that night. But this obsession with inequality, and I mean the Gini coefficient, which I think you tangentially referred to there, is the measure by which all of this is calculated. There are obviously lots of poor people and lots of rich people in every part of the world. And these arbitrary borders that we've drawn around our countries are a very bad way to formulate where and when and how people are adjudicated to be rich and poor. I mean, you could look at the Eastern Cape, for example, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's living, a billionaire lifestyle over there. You could look in Gauteng, you'd probably find a few more. But this obsession with the extreme rich and the extreme poor kind of leaves all the people in the middle who are keeping the country going sitting with nothing to talk about because they're just victim of whatever tax system is employed if they're at the top, or they're victim of whatever government incapability of distributing that tax. They fall victim to that, on the other hand. It just doesn't seem to work.
But also, I don't think it's that imaginative. I mean, when the conversations about the basic income grant are not very different to the conversations that were had all those many years ago by the squeezers of this world. And what failed, I think, in that system, and there's no way that we can look back and say, well, maybe the initial grant system did lift a lot of people out of poverty and did kind of grease the wheels for a lot of individuals to be able to move out of their poverty. But what we never had is we never had a system that says, how do we take off these people from this reliability on this grant, right? And so if you don't have an exit system on the other side, is you simply just have lots and lots of people coming into the grant system and standing in the queue for grants and never in any way on the other side saying, how do we get people out of the grant system? And I think one of the biggest flaws of the basic income grant conversation that we are having is really a conversation that is unimaginative in that it says, on the one side, we're going to tax these people so that we can redistribute the tax on this side. But that's not very imaginative. There are many other ways in which to look at how do we lift people out of poverty? How do we move people out of the environment that they're in? And what does that look like? The reality is that we don't have the thinking, right? We don't have, and we spoke about thinking in the last hour. We were speaking about thinking and the research and the information that needs to go. We don't have the people. We don't have the people in Kizbeta to say, how do we fix SARS from where it is? We don't have the people in our ministerial positions to fix it, because they only see one lens, and their lens is an old lens with which they are looking at all of these things. And this is why we keep getting stuck in this malaise that we are in. Yeah. That's just my thing about the basic income grants. I think we're stuck with old thinking. It's not new. It's not imaginative. And it's not going to solve our problems.
I would say, look, I mean, nobody, and certainly it's not the position of the foundation that this happen in isolation, right? It has to go alongside, job creation, stimulation of the economy. I mean, we're talking about a grant at the moment of 350 Rand, right? I mean, it doesn't even meet the food poverty line. It's not as if it's, that money, and the studies have been done. This is not a disincentive to actually join the job market if there is a job available to you. But the fact is, and I mean, I know it might be boring, but the reality of South Africa is that there are children who are going to bed malnourished. There are adults who are going to bed without food in their stomach. And the fact is that if we want a sustainable South Africa, we are going to have to address that. And we're going to have to show that the Constitution actually takes seriously the reality of those individuals' lives.
Have we ever...
And so it's not...
Go ahead.
No. Just that the idea is that this is not something that is there in perpetuity. It's not something in place of job creation and economic stimulation policies, but it's there as a basic underlying social security net, which is essentially promised in our constitution in terms of social assistance to those who need it.
Well, I mean, we saw in America, and it's the most obvious example I can draw from recent history, during COVID, we saw the government literally writing checks to Americans of all kinds, and particularly poor Americans. And those amounts were not insignificant. They were high level grants, and government didn't say you could do this or that or the other with your money. They just gave you the money, and it was paid into people's bank accounts, and it led to people sitting at home, quitting their jobs and doing less. And that's obviously if you give them enough. If you give them too little, it does absolutely bugger all, because they're unable to actually fight the poverty which is keeping them in its tight clutches, and it makes it very, very difficult for those people to make themselves independent of government, even for that 350 Rand. Plus, I think it's just so undignified that our government thinks it's something to boast about that we have 16 or 17 million people on 350 Rand a day. I think that's appalling. I think it's a dereliction of duty of the highest order by government that they've mismanaged the economy to the degree that many people are dependent on that little money and consider it, and the government considers it an achievement. It's outrageous.
Sure. I mean, I think, again, there's much to agree with there. I mean, you see what the U.S. economy is doing, the job creation numbers, right? I mean, so that there was a helping hand created, and there has been significant sort of economic growth and job creation and in recent months in the United States. I think that you are right, and
also
just
there's also huge amounts of inflation that's been created, and that is going to affect absolutely everybody, especially the poor.
Everybody.
Well, that's what happens when governments just print money and they hand it out to people. It's not a way to guarantee any kind of long-term prosperity for anyone. Modern monetary theory. I mean, this is, if anything is disproven modern monetary theory, it is precisely this. Am I right? I mean, even from your days at the Business Day when this was, remember when, what was his name? Piketty. Thomas Piketty came out here to South Africa, and he was regaled as some kind of financial genius, and his ideas were considered to have been revolutionary and thoughtful, and academics all over the place were in high praise of his ideas. If anything has proven that modern monetary theory is an absolute disaster, it has to be that Janet Yellen herself the other day said, the woman who was first of all in charge of the Fed and was printing money, and who's now acknowledged that she just doesn't understand inflation. Those are her exact words. I didn't understand. This is the kind of the level of hypocrisy and stupidity that we get at the high end of the bureaucracy. If modern monetary theory needed an example in which to completely disabuse itself of the notion that anything in there is sensible, then this is it. And America is teaching itself and the world a hard lesson.
Yeah.
But and again, though, I mean, the idea of making a grant available to South Africans does not require a monetary policy, which is essentially about printing money, right? And so it's about a discussion about the ways in which we do that in a way that is financially and economically sustainable for our country. And so I do think, again, I mean, sometimes this debate breaks down into these extremes. And what we are, you know, what we are suggesting is that there needs to be a conversation because in order to give people the dignity of jobs, and I agree with you, that is, you've got to ensure that they survive, right? And that they have food to put in their mouths. And for many, many South Africans right now, the reality is the only way that they do that is by getting a grant. And so it's not for a lifetime.
I want to ask a question that's going to shift this conversation slightly. So, you know, just speaking of the areas in which people can participate in the economy, one of the things that we've seen, and I saw that the Helen Suzman Foundation was one of the signatories to an open letter to the president in Johannesburg. For those of you who may not have seen it, in Johannesburg very recently, there was an issue with permits and street vendors and the MMC for economic development. Mm-hmm. And which, you know, because there is this growing movement that seems to see individuals in particular parts of our economy either as foreign and therefore illegal and therefore taking jobs from South Africans. And there was this issue in Johannesburg recently with Seri, right? That's what they're called.
Seri, yeah.
which has led to an enormous outcry, even from civil society groups, about the level of freedoms that South Africans in those parts of the economy of South Africa are able to operate because of being victimized by people who want to be our government. What is your view on that little exercise, I mean, as we've seen it over the past couple of weeks unfolding?
Obviously, I mean, one is just that, you know, again, this is just such irresponsible action on the part of our government to attack civil society and to attack Siri in the way in which was done, you know, for work that they were doing in respect of those street traders and ensuring that their positions were protected by law. But it speaks to, I mean, that letter also mentions the attacks that the Helen Suzman Foundation received from the Minister of Home Affairs, Aaron Motsoaledi. And this is in respect of a case that we're bringing, challenging the termination of the Zimbabwe exemption permits.
Right.
In respect of that case, Minister Motsoaledi has, you know, taken issue with us for taking his department to court, has called us part of a dictatorship of NGOs. it was really kind of incendiary language. But this is a case which relates to around 178,000 Zimbabwean nationals who have lived in this country perfectly lawfully for well over a decade as part of this special dispensation regime, which has involved a kind of rollover of several permits. The most recent being the Zimbabwe exemption permit. And in November last year, essentially, Cabinet made a decision. It was announced that permit would be terminating at the end of December 2021 and that there would be a grace period given, allowing permit holders essentially to transfer to other forms of visas or permit status or to apply for a waiver. But by the December 2022, they would have to have done so or they would be illegal in South Africa. They would have to return to Zimbabwe. What they then found out is, in fact, that there was no legal basis to grant a grace period. So they've actually extended the permit for the year, and it is now terminating in December 2022. But it essentially means that these 178,000 Zimbabwean nationals who, as I said, have been here lawfully, scrupulously observing the law, for well over a decade have founded families, careers, homes here, are put to this invidious choice, right? Because it actually is an illusory option to suggest that they can migrate to other visas. They're simply not available. So they will have to stay here as illegals, or they will return to Zimbabwe, which is essentially unchanged from the country that they fled more than a decade ago. And what, unfortunately, this has led to, and again, I think, you know, irresponsible, desperate political actors have been keen to sort of inflame this and inflame the kind of rhetoric against foreigners. And so there has been a huge kind of response against this action from those like Put South Africa First and Operation Dudula.
And this does have a, you know, kind of conflates with what we were speaking about with freedom under law and what our constitution allows and where our constitution is, and now essentially kind of putting in jeopardy where we have politicians who quite blatantly are willing to break the tenets of our constitution simply because it makes them popular on the ground.
Yeah, I have enormous sympathy for people who are from foreign countries and who receive no protection from our own, you know, criminal justice system, because really there's just nowhere for them to go if, you know, their shop is just shut down by the police, if members of a community take action and take the law into their own hands and enact all kinds of violence and ugliness upon them. That's all awful, and I don't think anyone with a good conscience or anyone who's thought sensibly about this for more than 5 minutes can possibly defend. But I do worry. I worry about, like, things. You mentioned SERI earlier, the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, right? I mean, these guys are essentially a foreign-funded NGO. And this does concern me, because these people are trying to change policy and they're trying to affect the way that South Africa is run, when South Africans have very little to do with their mandate because their funders are all international. And some of them, to my mind, I don't think some of them are particularly interested in what ordinary South Africans want. And this is where Operation Dudula and these kinds of things come from, because people are looking at this going, hang on, it doesn't seem right to me that someone is taking care of their interests, but they're not taking care of mine. And we do end up with massive amounts of dissatisfaction in communities that are already stretched to the maximum. So why should someone like SERI, with all of their international funding, be telling my government how to tax me?
So, Gareth, that's great, because actually this is a criticism that is made against all of us in civil society all the time, right? That, yeah. Your funders are foreign, you know, right. You're kind of sort of agents for, I don't know, various imperialist forces. I mean, that's not how NGOs work, right? I mean, the fact is, we are there. We do work in the nonprofit sphere. We rely, because we're not a commercial enterprise. We do rely on donors. And most of us, I mean, certainly, you know, reputable organizations like SERI, we take, you know, donations from across the board. I mean, it would be great. And there are some really fantastic South African philanthropic, donors who give money and do so generously. But actually, it's a really limited slice. And then there are, you know, international-based organizations, donor organizations, who give money, and there are a large variety of them. And my sense, I mean, I don't know in detail who SERI's funders are, but I imagine that they are, you know, some of the, you know, well-known, established international donor funders, and the relationship works in ways. There's no kind of like, oh, you know, we're having a meeting and you will do this, receive your instructions. I mean, the fact is, donors come as they do, as investors do, in sort of startups. We like your ideas. We like the work that you're doing. Here is your money. You have to report to us as to what you're doing. But we don't hand you a mandate as to what it is that you're required to do. I've never encountered that in my years of work.
I suppose the biggest funder there is the Open Society Initiative, Open Society International, which is clearly got a globalist bent and are into things like open borders and all the rest of it. So that does run counter to a lot of nationalist interests in South Africa, and particularly around people like Operation Dudula, and people who are more interested in, you know, if you are not from here and you are not complying with the law, then frankly, we don't care about your rights. And that's how they feel. I don't agree with that necessarily. But if that's true, if open borders are an important part of why certain organizations fund certain other organizations, then I think that should be something that the people of those countries are aware of. I mean, places like China, they don't allow any NGOs from outside. They don't allow any funding from outside. Now, we don't want to end up like that, because obviously then...
And there's a limit even in the States to what philanthropy is, you know, what kind of donations...
And Pumi, let's...
Especially international, but also...
Let's be fair. Like, this, you know, it's not always philanthropy either. Sometimes these are political interests, and I'm not going to get conspiratorial about imperial control from all over the world and all that stuff, which you rightly point out, Nicole, is mostly nonsense. But I do think there are a lot of very nefarious and dangerous competing interests out there, and sometimes the ones that have the most money win.
Gareth, but I do think that it is disingenuous of Aaron Motsoaledi, who is a minister in our government, who has levers of power at his disposal, to then also hide behind this, oh, there's some nefarious, what, they've got the power. He is, in fact, what he is doing is he is scapegoating foreign nationals and also the foreign donors of some of these organizations to hide away from the fact that he is running a department that is dysfunctional.
Yep.
It is his fault.
Absolutely.
If his department is unable to process permits in a particular period of time. Mm-hmm. It is his fault if his department is unable to manage and kind of look at border control. It is his fault if his department is full of corruption, that individuals within his department are easily manipulated or can be bought to create documentation that for nefarious reasons. And he is unable to say, we have faulted here and we are going to fix it in this manner, in this amount of time. It is easier for him to say, yeah, this an imperialistic kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, sure.
There's somebody there pulling the strings, and these strings are meant to make... And this is the problem with what we are seeing.
Right.
But I also think it is problematic when you have individuals who are supposedly vying for us as South Africans to vote for them, to take out the current government and put them in power, and they use the exact same excuses to scapegoat on, you know, punching down, as it were. Give us your ideas of what it is that you are going to do differently. How are you going to fix this without making it somebody else's? Oh, it's their fault. It's not our fault.
Correct. Couldn't agree more. Nicole?
Yeah. And I have to say, I couldn't agree with you more either, Pumi, in respect of your characterization of that. And of course, I mean, the irony is that we know that the ANC is now opposing and seeking to move down the levels of by which it is required in terms of the new legislation to disclose its funders, right? So here is this thing, you know, they're saying, oh, you sort of nefarious organizations funded by these stealthy, shadowy forces. But actually, we're sort of in Parliament going to be, you know, sort of lobbying to amend this law that requires us to disclose our funders because we don't want to have
to do that. They are idiots. They are idiots because they allowed that law in the first place. No, really, when that was initially kind of like put on the books, I just thought to myself, what the fuck would I agree to this for? The ANC, and you are the party in power. Why would you agree to this? But because they agreed to that, Gareth, and we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, what we now have access to is we actually have access to see who are these big corporates that are keeping the ANC and the EFF
Absolutely.
And the DA kind of in largesse. And the fact that it is the same people across the board, so the same people that give money to the EFF, give money to the ANC, give money to the DA.
Yes.
And so it's interesting and important for us all to also understand what then is the difference between all of these people on the other side.
Right? Well, and we know what's happening.
That the 350 Rand grant is what keeps the ANC in power. But actually, it is not the 350 Rand grant that keeps the ANC in power. It is the big businesses like the Bains down the line who create the opportunity for them to be able to capture. But also the 66 million, this is the, I think in the past 6 months, this is what the IEC have put out as monies that have been given to the various parties. I think the ANC got 66 million donations.
Yeah.
That 66 million is what they use to run their conferences. It's what they use to run the ads. It's what they use to make the t-shirts
right.
that keep them top of mind for the people who do show up to vote.
Couldn't agree
okay,
more.
I'm back yeah.
No, that's spot on. go ahead.
No, just to say, I mean, look, I think one of the things that you said out, Gareth, which, you know, is the hard reality, right? I mean, sometimes we present these things as kind of binary choices. They don't necessarily, that's not how they actually present themselves, but sometimes we do have to make choices. The fact is South Africa is experiencing all sorts of enormous demands and, you know, as our discussion in respect to the big revealed, it's not necessarily doing a good enough job in sort of responding to the needs of those who are poorest and most vulnerable here in this country. And so I get that people are going to be concerned that, you know, here are these organizations lobbying, protecting for foreign nationals. But I think what has to be recalled is we're making this decision in respect to the Zimbabwean exemption permit. We're talking about 178,000 individuals who've been here lawfully. They're a different category from those who have come into South Africa, foreign nationals, and who are here, you know, illegally and undocumented. In order to live here, they have had to scrupulously adhere to the law. We're making this decision without having taken into account any of the data, right? When we made the decision to give them these visas and these permits, it was on the basis that that it was in the interests of South Africa to track and record these persons coming into South Africa's economy. That in 2007, 2008, when so many Zimbabweans fled the political crisis in Zimbabwe and came into South Africa, that they were overwhelming our reception, our asylum refugee reception centers. Why suddenly, you know, we're now saying, okay, well, you can go and apply for these other visas when in 2007, 2008, we took a very different decision. There's no data suggesting that by expelling these 178,000 people, that will be a net positive effect for South Africa, for our economy. I mean, we have no idea to what extent these people actually employ South Africans, that they contribute
I'm fairly sure that it would be extremely deleterious to us. I don't think it would be good for our economy because I do see these people opening up shops where no one else is prepared to open up shops, doing work that no one else is prepared to do, very often with skills and qualifications and abilities that we don't have ourselves. So I don't think that I'm not on the other side of this argument from you. I think there are lots of these people who are making a huge contribution to the economy.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to Pumi's point, right? And certainly if you are going to make a decision, and I mean the amounts of, you know, kind of letters and messages that we're getting from individuals. So for instance, you know, a young man with a young family who wrote to me, he came here, he was initially a laborer. He's now started a small business and employs several South Africans. As I said, has two children, also suffering from a chronic illness, right? He has to go back to Zimbabwe. He's not going to be able to get the medication that allows him to survive on a day-to-day basis. So it's literally a death sentence. He won't have employment in Zimbabwe. There's no job waiting for him. He will have to abandon his business here, and it will be a literal death sentence for this particular individual. But there are so many circumstances, so many individuals who have just as desperate circumstances. And I think for us to make a decision as we've done, without any consultation, without any thinking, without any planning, must be, I think, frightening for all of us South Africans. Because if this group of individuals can have their lives tossed to the wind in the way that they are being by the South African government, I think it places all of us in jeopardy. And I think that is a reason that all of us South Africans should be concerned. And again, just to say that, of course, acting to seek to protect and defend the rights of these individuals is not at the cost of also working and lobbying for the rights of South Africans. And there it's not a, you know, either-or situation.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I agree with Pumi earlier when she said that actually so much of this would be solved instantly if we just had competence in cabinet and in government and in the executive branch of government. If people were just able to actually do what are already plentiful laws give them the ambit to do. If we were just applying that law rightly and fairly across the board and giving people the chance to actually be here legally, to participate in the economy properly, and to pay their taxes like anyone else, I don't think anyone would have the kind of grievance that they have in so many parts of South Africa against these foreign nationals. But we do have to sort it out, because it's not going away anytime soon, and it's probably going to boil over into violence again. It has before, and that should be avoided at all costs, I think. Most South Africans who care about the stability and the future of not only our economy but our society, I think, want people to try to, wherever possible, solve these problems peacefully. And we're not going to be able to if we don't deal with the root cause. Mm. All right. Well,
I think that's a good place to end it.
It's a good place to end it. It's also we're out of time, and really, Nicole, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. First of all, to explain some of the work that the Helen Sussman Foundation does, the stuff that you and so many others have done at Freedom Under Law. It's terrific that there are NGOs that are more than pulling their weight in a society where so often other more important players are not pulling their weight. It's good to see that there is a solid civil society. And I wish you only the best going forward. I hope that many more South Africans can contribute to that in time, in resources, in money, and in attention, so that the good messages get out there and the right stuff continues to percolate towards the top. Thank you for your hard work. It's good to have you on.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. So much.
Thanks, Pumi. It was lovely to join you. Thanks so much.
It was good to see you. Thank you. We didn't do an ad for her. How do people get in? Just before you go, how do people get in touch? How do people support you? How do people help? How do people become friends of the Helen Sussman Foundation?
So if you go on the website, there are tabs saying sort of contact, donate, become a friend. So go on the website. Particularly if you are friendly and wanting to support. If you're wanting to sort of beat me up because of our support for, you know, the Zimbabwe exemption permits, let me assure you I get enough of those messages. So by all means.
We need counter messages.
Exactly. If you want to come be a friend and support us, get in touch. Otherwise, I'm not sure how you get in touch with us.
No, otherwise, there's no way we can't help you. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Exactly.
All right. Terrific stuff. Thanks, Pums. We will see you next week. Cheers, everybody. Have an excellent Thursday. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.